Welcome to the Music Ed Matters podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Emily Williams-Birch, and this podcast, it exists for you. Whether you're a music lover, an educator, a choir member, each week we bring guests to the show to help explore what matters in music. I'm so glad that you're here. Welcome to the show. Hello, and welcome to the Music Ed Matters podcast, episode 53. We are talking today to Dr. Adam Lupke. Dr. Lupke is a Grammy-nominated choral educator who works at Fredonia up in New York, and he is going to share so much tangible information, especially about how you too can raise the bar for every singer. Teaser, it's about the people. And this one is a good one. So grab your notes. You're going to want to write some of these things down. As always, this episode is brought to you by our friends at the Kennison Choral Company. If you have not yet checked out their calculator, there's a link, emilybirch.org/sponsors. Click the KCC picture and it'll take you directly to that calculator. And that calculator, after this episode, could be where you start as you think about where your singers are, where your people are, where your community is, and what you can do to help them raise the bar to the next level. I don't want to give anything else away because this episode, as you can tell, I'm recording this intro after we recorded it. It left me ready and reeling to brainstorm and to get creative, and I hope it does the same for you. Jump over to patreon.com/musicedmatters if you want to join the conversation. And don't forget, we have Teacher PD Weekend coming up in July. More details on that in episode 48 and coming soon down the line. But oh my goodness, you have to hear Dr. Adam Lupke and how he, as a Grammy-nominated conductor, raised the bar for his entire choir. Today on the Music Ed Matters podcast, we are welcoming Grammy-nominated choral conductor, educator, awesome human extraordinaire, Dr. Adam Lupke. Hey, Adam.
Hi, Emmy. How are you?
I'm so excited to see you. How we've known each other since what, 2008 maybe?
2008, yeah. Florida State. I love the background you've got there.
Thanks. It's my new thing whenever I interview one of my FSU friends, both ones I know and don't know. If we have the FSU blood, I put it in the backdrop. You were a second year when I was a first year master's?
That sounds right. I was doing my second year of the doctorate. I started in 2007. So that's right. Yeah.
That's right. I remember you were super organized. And so this morning when I was so excited to have him, like, I know Adam's going to be at least 5 minutes early. So I turned on the Zoom room extra early today. It was so much fun. I've been really looking forward to chatting with you. Will you tell the listeners, who is Dr. Adam Lupke?
Yeah, I grew up outside of Philadelphia. And because I was in that region, I learned about a choir called the American Boy Choir. And they were based in Princeton, New Jersey. So I joined the American Boy Choir when I was 11, and we immediately found myself in Czechoslovakia. It was still Czechoslovakia at the time, and traveling around the world and singing at Carnegie Hall with Kathleen Battle and Wynton Marsalis and all this stuff. So I just sort of jumped into, I'd always been a great, I loved singing and sang at elementary school and all that, and all of a sudden jumped into this sort of professional realm of singing, and then I just needed more of that. I wanted to find the best choirs to sing in. So that's how I kind of traced my story. I'm like, I want to find the best choir I can sing in. And so I went to St. Olaf College because I saw the St. Olaf Choir give a concert when I was in high school. I was like, I want to sing in that choir. And then after St. Olaf, I went to Westminster Choir College for my master's and got to sing with Westminster Choir and Westminster Symphonic Choir. And then I sort of struck out and did all kinds of crazy odd jobs and random music jobs. And I like to tell this story to students. It's like, you just kind of do what you have to do. I had all kinds of adjunct positions in Kentucky. I lived in Lexington, Kentucky, as well as like did catering work for Jerry Bruckheimer and like all kinds of just crazy stuff. And then ended up at Florida State for my doctorate with Andre Thomas, where I got to meet you and so many wonderful people. And now I've been in Western New York for about 5 years. And I teach at SUNY Fredonia, which is one of the larger state schools with the music programs. We have 140 voice majors between music theater and therapy and all of that stuff. So it's a nice, big, robust program. And I teach voice and conducting there. And I also am the music director for the Buffalo Philharmonic Chorus. Been doing that for 5 years. And so that's a big chorus of amateur singers. Primarily, we have some paid singers, but it's like a big community choir that gets to sing with the orchestra, which is like awesome. It's so much fun.
I love that that goes full circle back to where you started at 11, finding, you know, professional choir experiences. Before we go deeper, can we talk more about this whole piecemealing what happened between master's and doctorate? Because I love this. I always say I'm a triangle in a square world because I don't follow the normal path. I'd love to hear more about what you did. So when you got out of Westminster, you did what first?
I looked for jobs, but not real. I mean, not as seriously as I ought to have probably. And my girlfriend, now wife at the time, went off to do her master's at the University of Kentucky in Lexington. So I'm like, well, I'm going to just strike out to Kentucky and see what I can do. And I ended up having a church job at a small rural church. I think the choir had like 6 people in it. And here I am coming from Westminster, you know, singing with at ACDA conferences and stuff like that. And so I did that. And I ended up conducting in choirs at Morehead State University, which is out in eastern Kentucky in Morehead. Greg Detweiler is the conductor there. And he took a chance on me. And I'm forever grateful for him for doing that, because I got a lot of great experience doing that. And I drove an hour and a half every Monday night to conduct those choirs. But I worked a day job, you know, in an HR office for a while. And I had some experience doing catering work. So that was like the first thing I did. It pays well. And it was, you know, I was young, so I could be up all hours of the night. And pretty much every weekend in the summer and fall, I was doing catering work. And then I eventually got more and more stuff. So I started teaching at a private school part-time, and that became full-time. So over 3 years, I got a different church job and was able to put on, you know, a Vivaldi Gloria and a Mozart Mass and, you know, do some more stuff. So I just had to sort of strike out and make it happen. I mean, I had like 5 or 6 different, 1099s coming in at one point.
It's part of the fun, right? What did you learn from catering and this HR job that helps you today in the music world?
The HR job actually has taught me a lot about, how to help people, because I was literally hired to help people. It was at a bookbinding plant, and I was hired to help people understand their healthcare plans and like the options. So I had to really I'd understand what healthcare plan options are, which were just completely Byzantine and still are. And, then explain it to people who were just coming off like the third shift, you know, it really got me to sort of cut through the difficulty and the fat and get right to like, okay, this is what this means for you. This is how it lays out. And that's really helpful for me. And it's one of the things I talk about in Raising the Bar is like just getting right to the point and being really clear, and understanding what people need and how you can communicate to them in that way. So that was really helpful. In that environment, and catering, like it was just, you know, meeting lots of different people, like everybody in catering, you know, that's not their final job. You know, there are a few who are the chefs or like the head people who've been doing it and make a career out of hospitality, but everybody sort of is on a path somewhere. And so intersecting with all these different people was really cool. There's a lot of sort of self-starter in catering. It's like, because the time limit is like, okay, you're there 2 hours or 3 hours for an event and everything has to get done and there's never enough time. So it's just like, what can I do now? What can I do now? What can I do now? And so it was very much like problem solving and keeping focused on just getting something done, because there's always something to get done.
This is how incredible that you were able to go from these 2 amazing choir schools and all of this professional choir experience from age 11 to your early 20s, and you were able to support Sarah on her journey at UK while also learning these amazing transferable skills and to see them pay off. I'm just saying this I want to hear it for myself later. Yeah. The stuff you're doing now will pay off later if you're intentional about the transfer and the time. This is such a cool, okay, I'm really excited.
Yeah.
Can you please walk us through this whole, how did you even get a Grammy nomination? And what is this process like? Like, give us a little bit of that before we actually hit Raising the Bar.
Yeah, so much of the Grammy, you know, it's how life works. Like, I was in the right place at the right time with the right project, and then I just worked my tail off. And so when I first got the job with the Philharmonic Chorus, It's like a separate nonprofit from the orchestra, but we're the principal partner for choral music. So the conductor, Joanne Folletta, is a wonderful conductor, wonderful person. And she has her friend, Richard Danielpour, the composer from Juilliard days, from college days. So it's all these connections, you know, that you build throughout your lifetime. Well, he had this piece that he'd been working on for 10 or 12 years or so, is his baby, called The Passion of Yeshua. And Joanne helped bring it to the fore. Like, it was a co-commissioned by the Buffalo Philharmonic and the Oregon Bach Festival and another foundation. And so she's like, well, we will mount it. We will record it for Naxos. And so when I got the job, she sat me down and said, okay, we have this project in like 4 years.
And they knew that it was coming for, okay, that's another skill. Look at how far out you're planning. If you see the big picture, oh, this is so good. Okay.
It was like 3 or 4 years before it even was like going to happen. I'm like, oh wow, this is great. And I even like, you know, kept like, I'm like, I had a couple of opportunities to do other things. I'm like, no, I really want to do this project, you know, to move maybe or go to another place. And it paid off. I mean, this was Richard Danielpour's baby. He nursed it and he pushed it and pushed it and pushed it with the Grammys situation. All of that is kind of very political and insider stuff. And he's based in LA. So like, he's right there where it's all happening. And he really pushed it and it got the recording. I was able to work with a new colleague, James Bass, who is the director of choral studies at UCLA, and his chamber singers came out and joined the Philharmonic chorus. And so there was a great exchange in that way where they got to like be on stage with a professional group. But we also, like, my singers got to see this young, fresh enthusiasm, particularly for a piece that was kind of hard to sink our teeth into at first. And so just all these things sort of came together at the right time. I was in the right place, and I called so many extra rehearsals for that preparation. And I remember Joanne Folletta usually comes to visit the chorus just the week before a concert season. She came like 2 or 3 weeks before, I think it was 3 weeks before the actual performance, just to like check in, you know, and see, make sure that it was okay. And that really helped everybody sort of gain the seriousness of it and helped us know what we really needed to focus on in those last 2 weeks to get together. So it was just kind of all those things happened. And it happens to be like, and Joanne Folletta does a lot of recording for Naxos. She's won 3 Grammys already. And this recording just happened to be a choral piece that, you know, I was in the neighborhood for. So it was a lot of fun. I worked hard to try to get the singers to get to that level. And so that's what I'd like you to talk about a little bit today.
Definitely. Just before we dive into how to raise the bar so we can make this applicable, I just want to point out a few things that you said that are resonating right now, hardcore. I like feel vibrations. So you did a lot of hard work with intentionality, focused on a goal. You shared that goal with everyone around you, including your choristers. You collaborated with people. You had partnerships with people. And you were not afraid to call the extra rehearsals, to put in the extra time, and to say no to other opportunities so you could focus on that one goal. I don't know who needs to hear that, but man, this is a great story. Okay, let's talk about how you raised the bar. So this is a group of amateurs with you. How did you get them to professional level, to Grammy-nominated level?
Well, I think, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this now that's actually happened. And I've been reading a lot of sort of organizational management ideas too. And you sort of just, and it's so much of what we do as teachers and conductors is to tap into the strengths of the people that we have in front of us. And so that's part of it, is sort of recognizing who is there in the room and what are their strengths and what kind of, what can they give to this team endeavor? Because it is a team endeavor. And so and knowing their strengths, but also knowing their weaknesses. So I sort of plan primarily more for their weaknesses than their strengths. What do I need to bone up and shore up for them? And then knowing like how people respond, how are they going to respond to certain things that I say, certain elements that we do in rehearsal, what is going to motivate them? How are they going to respond? So it's really about knowing your people. And that's
community,
right?
Right.
But it's so important. And knowing, and you know, this group is it, they're all lovers and they want to do the absolute best they can. And so I just sort of said to them from the beginning, this is a once in a lifetime opportunity for us and for you to premiere this piece, to do beyond a recording, a world premiere recording, that when, you know, the graduate students at the University of Michigan are studying Passions, they're going to listen to you. You know, they're going to pull out the recording and it's going to be you. You're going to be the definitive performance of this piece. And so that kind of really resonated with people to sort of say, okay, this is really important.
You and shared so your why to the community. Yeah. Did you do that? Sorry to interrupt. Did you do that at year three or two or when did, or the year you recorded it? When did you actually start verbalizing the vastness and the possibilities of this project with the singers?
When it was the start of the season. So the okay. concert happened, I think, in April, and we started work on it probably October, November, but really dug into it in January, started in January. But you know, this, you see it on the schedule and everybody's more excited about the Mozart Requiem because they know that piece and they can, it resonates with them and they love it. And it's amazing. It's a great piece to do. I love doing that. But you really need to, in order to raise the bar, I think you really need to lay out the stakes. What are the stakes? And it's not just for a group like this, it's for kids too. Like, you know, mm-hmm. this is the one chance that that these people get to hear you sing, right? Or I remember being taught in the American Boy Choir, you know, no matter who's in the audience, they've come and they need to hear you sing, right? So that's the stakes for this performance. First of all, they paid money. You have to give them the best because they paid money. But more importantly, whether it's two people or 2,000, they're there because they're there to hear something and to experience what you have to offer. And so laying out the stakes for it was crucial. And two, seeing it on the calendar, it's like, oh, what is this piece? It's got a weird title, Richard Daniapour. I don't know who that is. It looks like it's in Hebrew, which is not a huge hurdle, but it's a little bit of like, you know, a little foreign for most.
Just a little out of people's comfort zones.
Right? Mm-hmm. And so I just had to talk about it, you know, and I talked about it as part of the tradition of the Bach Passions, because something they can relate to. We had luckily just a couple of years before done Bernstein's Chichester Psalms, and there's a lot of similarities with that, particularly in terms of text and some of the...
Did you plan that intentionally?
Nope.
But you made the connection and you made the transfer. Made the
connection. Yeah.
That's making their eyes open to the transfer, to the connections, to something familiar. I actually just heard a little quote about how, you know, if you're a boat in harbor, you're safe. But boats weren't actually designed to be in a harbor. They were designed to be out in the water. But to get to the water, you have to go through the ravine. And the ravine is scary and it's things you don't know, but it's surrounded by your comfort zone. So if you jump out of your comfort zone and into that ravine, you jumped out of Mozart into this amazing new piece and look what came out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I bet after everything happened, even before the Grammy nomination, just be on the recording and be part of the experience, I bet, you know, if we went down the row, the majority of people would say this was one of their most inspiring and memorable musical experiences, just going through the process of all that. And so it's really about getting everybody invested in some way, speaking to them so that they can get invested. And I think about, you know, the literature for the business world, it's all about, you know, you have to meet deadlines, right? And so how do you motivate people to meet the deadline? Well, you build in motivations, you build in bonuses, you build in all kinds of incentives to get there. And so in my world, it was sort of like, these are the incentives. Like, this is going to be a unique experience, the one of a kind of thing. You know, those are the incentives that meet people on the path to get to that deadline, because it is a deadline. And I've had fun conversations with some of the players in the orchestra. It's really stressful. I mean, I definitely lost some sleep over this piece.
No doubt.
But one of the conversations I've had with a friend, buddy of mine who went to Interlaken for high school, a great music art school, did his master's and bachelor's at Juilliard. And he's the principal trombone player. And he's like, you know, and I'm like, you know, I feel like I'm only really as good as my last concert, you know? That's how high the stakes are sometimes. And he's like, yeah, yes. I had a teacher once say, you're only as good as the last note you play. Because which is really, you know, humbling to think about. It's kind of a it takes all the process out of it. But to a point, it's true. Like you have to, you're always trying to increase, to raise that bar. You're always trying to like get to the best of your potential, actualize your best potential with every step of the way. So,
so you start with getting them invested and then you told them how to stay motivated through it and you related it to business practices. Oh, I'm sorry I interrupted you. This is just so good. Like I feel like people need to be taking notes because this is so transferable to your classroom, to your project, to your life. What happened as you started, once they were invested and they were motivated to those checkpoints, to the little bonuses along the way, what was it like in rehearsals? What are other things you did?
It was pretty intense. And this is where I think sometimes in education, and I get bogged down in teaching, like I'm really trying to get people to teach them what I want them to know. And I've learned a little bit along the way, like from one of Dr. Bowers, Judy Bowers things is she teaches the rules of expressive singing. So I teach that and I give, and I think of that more as tools. I'm giving my singers tools. So I give them a marked score. I give them a pronunciation and translation and I give them these kinds of tools and I assume that they're smart. I assume that they're going to do this stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I don't kind of dwell on hammering that kind of stuff home. It's more about, getting everything to come together. And I sort of want them to figure things out, make this, like you said, make transfers, and make connections. And so I expected them to work outside of class rehearsal. I gave them clear assignments like, okay, by this date, we're going to work on this and you need to have it learned. And I might call on you in rehearsal, you know, and so they knew clearly what the expectations were, the deadlines were, but I also gave them the tools to get to that point. I try not to like dwell on, okay, it's a long note. You've got a crescendo. Like I sort of say, what do we do on that long note so that they know what they're supposed to do? Rather than tell them, I assume that they are smart and want to be there. And in most, this is not true for all, music situations, but for a lot of them, or at least the ones that I found myself in, most people choose to be there in some way. You know, and I realize that there are some general ed classes where people are just dumped into a classroom. But where I am at a college, the kids have chosen to be music majors. And in the adult world, they've chosen to give up 3 hours every week. And so I assume that starting point, that they're going to be smart and they're going to take ownership and sort of just expect that as the norm. And I think that helps them a lot too, just sort of do it because, you know, it's already an expectation. So
you gave them clear expectations. You're building that empowered community out of a group of amateurs by sharing where we're going. Here's your motivation. Here are the tools. Like, this is so helpful. Okay. What's next?
Talking about giving expectations is also like being really clear. And this is something I also learned at Florida State. I learned along the way, but clearly it came out at Florida State. The idea of limited teacher talk, be very clear and specific. First of all, it saves a lot of time, but it really helps people, give themselves invested rather than you trying to tell them what to do all the time. Mm-hmm. And so like the whole 7 words or less thing that Jessica Annapolis has talked about, and giving them specific, clear routines, you know, how I tell them where we're starting is always the same. So they know, can find it right away. It's never kind of, oh, I wonder where he is. Mm-hmm. And when I rehearse, I really try really hard to use musical terms, musical nomenclature, because I'm going to assume that they're smart and they know it. And if they don't, they'll figure it out, you know, particularly with college kids, like they don't always know what some of these things mean, but by expecting them to know it, they're going to have to figure it out. And then I give them the why, if I'm asking for a certain style characteristic or a certain, you know, breath mark in a certain place, I give them kind of why so that just so that they can make the connection and then do it themselves the next time. Right. And it also helps them understand my investment in the music. I see it this way. I hear it this way. I think this is going to be the best for everyone to bring it together that way. So I try to, you know, if there's like a, you know, specific musical decision that has been made, tell them why we want to carry through there. Maybe it has to do with the text. Maybe it has to do with the larger architecture of the phrase. But those kinds of simple things. So it's not arbitrary. It is something that they can make a connection to and then, you know, use later on.
It really does build that community too. All these pieces are almost step-by-step processes, but they all work well together. What you're telling us, these tools, and if whoever is listening doesn't get anything else other than 7 words or less, tell them exactly what you want and why and the same direction in the music every time. Man, that might change some people's lives right then and there.
Yeah. And I can go on and on in rehearsal. Like I can, you know.
Can't we all?
Not because I want to hear myself talk or anything, but just because like I think I get really excited, you know, and I'm enthusiastic about things and I want to say, oh, but this and this and this.
Yes.
But so much of it is I've learned so much of it is not just me telling them they need to be enthusiastic, but it's helped showing them so that they can become enthusiastic on their own, right? Mm-hmm. They can become committed and invested to the music and the music making process on their own. And that's why I sort of take the assumption, assume that they're going to do it, assume that they're going to be smart, assume that they're going to work hard. And so much of, I think about, you know, I really wish we could have like a team meeting every week, you know, how like in offices, they have a team meeting. Mm-hmm. Okay. How are we doing on this? How are we doing on this? And everybody gets to like, to chime in and show their accountability and offer a little bit. And we don't have time to do that most of the time, but there are times when I like to like point out, you know, ask people, okay, well, what's really hard for you right now? Or, you know, why do you think we're doing this? And with college students, I have more time and I try to get them to sort of think more creatively and because it helps prepare that they're younger and help prepare them. I don't know why, but, so I'll just give them index cards and I'll have them like jot down, you know, a question to a prompt about the music or where what's working and what's not working so that they can be accountable to themselves and point out things for me that I might not know. So I'm trying to figure out this concept of the team meeting and how to make it work in a rehearsal situation without taking more than, you know, 5 minutes.
It's hard. We've been using Google Forms because we've been virtual this whole time, which I want to talk about in a second, how you did all of this through the pandemic, but we'll get there in a second. We've been doing forms at like Google Forms at the end of every rehearsal. They click on a link in their choir classroom and submit, what did I learn this week? What do I need help on? This is what I thought of rehearsal. This is what I want you to know. And they do it every week. And it has been so helpful to hear. It's like as they're waving goodbye in the Zoom room. But I'm like, how am I going to make this a thing in real rehearsal time? But those team meetings, I love how you're making the connection to the business world because choir is ultimately one ginormous people business.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think of it like, you know, we as leaders are literally like working with a team of some sort, right? And so it's all about team, teamwork and team training and team motivation and all of that stuff. And so I'm trying to like think about how it's one of my things right now is trying to figure out how to make it work better, right? How to make it work more effectively and efficiently and get people involved and accountable. So I love this form idea. I love this feedback. And one thing we've done with the Philharmonic course is we've done feedback. And I stole this from Tim Selig, steal everything that is a great idea. He has accountability forms and we use Google Forms. And so I call them musical mishaps. And so that way nobody can raise their hand in a rehearsal. If something comes up, you note it and then you can send me a form and I'll figure it out.
Or
you
can let the section
leader know, you know, like that saves a ton of time in rehearsals.
Yes.
And the other is like just another kind of accountability. So this didn't happen right. Or we had trouble getting off and on stage because of this. And so that's more for like the logistical kinds of things. But it also, the people have a lot of interesting things to say about rehearsing and like, well, we spent a really long time on this. I don't know why. And it often comes off kind of a little bit acerbic or aggressive, but at the same time, it's really helpful to consider what the experience of the person in the chair in front of you is like.
You're giving them a voice. Yeah. You're not just giving them a place to be accountable or to share, but you're giving them a voice, which goes all the way back in the circle to this beautiful community that you built that was almost like a, it's like you created this bubble of that fostered empowerment and motivation and goal-oriented progress towards this massive thing. But all these little things along the way created the bubble culture. It's really cool. A bubble in a good way, not a bad way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think part of it too is I sort of said, I said it to myself early on, particularly in the process for this, this recording, was like, okay, it's got to be good. So what am I going to do? What can I do differently to change how people approach rehearsal, how people approach the ensemble, not in a massive, you know, structurally different way, but just come at it with a little bit more, with a different, slightly different approach, you know, to sort of undergird what the seriousness of it is, but also how we can do better than we think we can, you know. And so much of raising the bar is letting people know that they can do better than they think they can, right?
Setting those high expectations.
Finding a way for people, and finding a way for people to do their best. If it's on the soccer field, like the rest of the team makes space for that really good player to like do all of his moves. And so how do we do that in a core rehearsal? Well, we give everybody the right tools so that everybody can jump up to the next level of what the star singer is doing. And then the star singer can do even more, right? Mm-hmm. You know, even more leadership in the kinds of stuff that they're doing in the rehearsal.
You're raising the bar for everyone. Everyone's bar is going to be at a different space, but the key is we're all just raising our bar together, whatever that next level is for you, through communication, empowerment, community building, tools, resources, communication, all the great words that you're sharing. How did you do all this in a pandemic? Because you said you started rehearsals in January, and I'm assuming that's January of 2020, so I'm dying to know, how did this all really happen?
Well, the performance and recording happened in 2019.
Okay.
So it was released in 2020. So that was lucky. We got everything done.
Okay. I was really stressed about that. I'm like, how did we do this in 2020? Because it said 2020. Okay. You did it all in 19.
We all did it all in 19. And we were very fortunate in that our 2019-2020 season was basically all of our orchestral stuff was done in February. We had done everything beforehand. So we had two big concerts canceled. And we're going to remount them next year in the spring. But they were kind of independently produced concerts that were slightly different. So what we've been doing in the pandemic, we have not done anything, you know, wild and crazy, innovative. We've been doing the Zoom rehearsals. We've been mixing it up with social time. And we've been doing some enrichment time right now, which has been really nice. I stole this from Michael Hannawalt in the Dallas Community Chorus. We do a session on vocal training and how to keep your voice fresh because they haven't been singing for 10 months, a year. I did a session on the background of For a Requiem. We had our accompanist, who's a fabulous harpsichord player, talk about the harpsichord and how it works. And because we do Messiah every year and we use the harpsichord. So like she got to show that off and everybody was just flabbergasted, like, wow, you do all of that. And it's like, so
you're building that community though, like you set the tone. Adam, you have to know that what you did in this whole 2019 set the tone for your choir to be successful in the pandemic, because they have this beautiful community and you're fostering it through all of this. I'm really thankful you're sharing this story.
we did do one really cool project in the fall, in that we do a big Messiah every year, sell out two venues, 2,000 some people. And we couldn't do that. So I thought, I had this vision of like doing a video performance of Messiah in a bunch of different spaces, because Buffalo is just an architectural gem of a city. There's just such amazing turn of century architecture. So much, we could do a concert in a different venue for like 6 or 7 years and it would be magnificent. It's just, there's so much great architecture. So we ended up using 4 spaces, but I recorded small groups spaced out with masks, singing along to a pre-recorded string quartet that I pre-recorded with in the concert hall. So they were listening with an earbud, singing alive in a church while I was conducting along with the earbud. And we videoed it, and it was on PBS, the local PBS station. And it turned out really cool because it showed off all these different buildings in Buffalo. And, you know, it's very much a product of the pandemic. But it, but it turned out really well. And this, that everybody sort of, that was something to look forward to again, like a project, like this is different. We're going to find a way to do Messiah because it's like our thing.
And you spotlighted your community. Yeah. Look at you being aware. This is such good stuff we all need to hear. So, I feel like I could go raise the bar on something. I'm going to have a big brainstorm session after this. I just feel it coming. This has been super helpful. Okay, is there anything else on your raising the bar list that we need to know before I ask you the final question?
Well, I think, no, that's pretty much it. You know, just it's so much like to rehash it. It's sort of like knowing who your people are, right? Laying out the stakes for them, you know, getting them on board, invested in what you're doing. Assume that they want to be there. I like the idea that assume that they're smart. You know, people are smarter than we think they are, and can make connections, and really, particularly if they're invested in what you're doing, let them figure things out. Give them clear instructions and clear expectations, and then reap rewards.
So perfectly summarized. Thank you. I always let the guest share one thing that really matters that you want the listener to walk away with. So the floor is all yours. Other than raising the bar and a million other things you've shared us with, what is the thing that matters?
The thing that matters that I've learned is that, you know, it's making music with people is about the people who are in the room with you, right? You've got to serve and lead the people who are there, and not necessarily the people you want to be there or the people that you have dreams about. And so it's so much of knowing who those people are, so much of getting out of my comfort zone and like making small talk with them and knowing who they are and where they come from and what their motivations are for being there. And then understanding their talents and their weaknesses. It's important to know where people need support and help. All of that, you know, it's a little bit cliche to say it's all about the people, but I think that that's how you can really raise the bars. You have to look around the room and use the talents and skills of the people who are there and highlight them. I think that's what good leaders do in general. They sort of can look around and say, this person's really good at that, and this person's really good at that, and I need to help them with this, I need to help them with that. And I could, well, maybe Susie can help John with that, you know, seeing all of those connections and seeing that. So it's about knowing who you're with, I think.
That's so beautiful. It's been an honor to spend this time with you. Thank you so much, Dr. Lupke.
Well, thank you for the time. It's been great to see you again and to chat.
Yes, we will definitely talk more soon. I'm really excited to go raise the bar. I'm going to go have like a huge brainstorm session now. People. It's about the people. Raise the bar by getting the most out of your singers, knowing where they are, what they need, what tools they need, and leading with empathy. You too can be at the right place at the right time, but you have to work. Make those life connections, make the transferable skills, use organizational management techniques from the business world, and collaborate and tap into the strengths of the people around you. Stop now and think, who is in the room with you? And what can you give them to empower your team? I cannot wait to hear how you raise the bar. Please reach out and let me know. You can find me on Instagram, Dr. Emmy B. Connect with me, emilybirch.org/contact, or better yet, join the conversation over at patreon.com/musicedmatters. I'm really thankful that every week I get to help you think about things and learn and grow. And it is an honor to be your host. Thank you for giving me ideas and options to raise the bar in my own personal world every day. So in case no one has told you, you matter. Obviously, music matters. And I'll see you next time on the Music Ed Matters podcast.